Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Tulsa Opera's production of Dead Man Walking opened over the weekend, and one of the sidebars of this powerful piece has been a community discussion about capital punishment. Capital punishment is still supported by about 60% of Americans, although that number is down from past years due to DNA exonerations and life without parole. My guest today has written a powerful piece on her role as a witness to the state's ultimate punishment. Kelly Kurt was a former Associated Press correspondent who witnessed 15 Oklahoma executions during her time with the organization. She recently witnessed her 16th when Gary Roland Welch was executed earlier this year. She's written about for the cover story of the latest issue of This Land, Death's Yellow Door, Life Inside an Execution Chamber. The piece is a balanced, nuanced look at this practice, which asks many questions that have no easy answers, despite the assertions of those that support and oppose capital punishment. Kelly Kurt joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Kelly Kurt, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The recent execution of Gary Roland Welch was the 16th you have witnessed as a reporter in the area next to the death chamber. Certainly witnessing 16 executions, that's a pretty rare event in our society today. In this wonderful article that you wrote for This Land, you sort of document how your mindset changed over the course of those 16 executions. Can you give us some insight?
Yeah, I felt it was important to write about this subject, first of all, again, because over time I've noticed that execution coverage has really decreased, been downplayed. And just thinking about that and kind of being away from having witnessed an execution, it had been 6 years since I'd seen one, I felt like it was important to write about it. So, yes, over time... I saw my first execution in 1996, and I was 26 years old. And, you know, you go into that first execution kind of ready to, you don't know what it's going to do to you.
I would think you would be, like, absolutely steeled to sort of control your emotions and sort of almost detach yourself from the situation.
Well, you're very detached because, for one thing, you're in there to do a job, which is to be a reporter, observe everything, write down what you're hearing, and then go back and tell the public what you saw and heard. And so you're very focused on doing a job when you're in there. And so when the first execution I saw, I went in, did my job, and was kind of unsure what it was going, its effect was going to be on me. And it amazed me or surprised me by not really having seemingly a big effect at all. I did my job, came out, said what happened, and then, you know, went on, wrote a story, later went home, and really it didn't seem to affect me. But over time, and this is what you asked me about, how it changed over time, is that probably about by the fifth execution, I started to notice that before I would be getting ready to go see an execution, that it would just start to feel like a weight was kind of on me. So and that kind of stayed with me over time. I witnessed executions mostly in the late 90s and early 2000s when the death chamber was at its busiest. And so I think part of that was just the amount of executions I was witnessing kind of piled up, and it began to have an effect, kind of a weight, almost like a burden of having to do this. And it was part of my job.
The AP is mentioned in the state statute, right?
Right. And the staff of the Associated Press is not very big in Oklahoma. It's even smaller now than it was when I was working there. And I happened to be in a position being in Tulsa where I was more available than some of the other people who had certain duties in Oklahoma City to go witness. So our office saw a lot of them. And it wasn't just me. It was other, you know, all my colleagues as well. But there were so many of them, and with a small staff, we all saw quite a few.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned how the attitude surrounding the carrying out of a capital sentence has changed since the 1990s. I remember, you know, when Oklahoma first began carrying out capital punishment again, you know, there would be large vigils. There would be people there in support of the death penalty. There would be people there against the death penalty. Was there many crowds in 2012?
Changed. I was a college student in 1990 when Charles Troy Coleman was the first person executed since the reinstatement of the death penalty. And I went down there. I did not witness that execution. There was like a long list of people who were trying to get in there, I guess, to see that. But I was in the room, and the place was jam-packed with media, and there were TV trucks and just lots of people there. You're right. There were vigils outside.
Counter-demonstrations.
Yeah, counter-everything. Yeah. And that went on for several years. You'd have a decent-sized crowd out there, and over the years that has kind of dwindled down. There are regulars who still go out there. But, just the attention. This execution I saw in January, there were 7 media witnesses, and that was like a really high number compared to what there had been in recent years. There have been times, I was told by the corrections department, there's been like 1 or 2 people there to witness the execution. So clearly the attention, you know, I don't know if it's an issue of resources. A lot of media outlets have had to downsize and that sort of thing, and maybe they don't have the resources to send someone down there. But the Associated Press always goes. I know when I worked there, it was considered a priority. We would be there. So that's how I ended up seeing so many as well.
Yeah. One of the things you address in the article is, you know, there's the argument that death penalty opponents make that the fact that today, you know, in the late 1800s, even in the early 1900s, executions were public affairs. They were carried out in public view. And now, today, in chambers all across the country, these are fairly secret proceedings except for a few media representatives and families of victims and families of the accused.
Right. Very, very few people actually witness an execution. There in Oklahoma, we have 12 media seats, and then there are certain law enforcement prosecutors in the case who are allowed in, and then the victims' families are in a separate chamber. We can't actually see them. They're right behind us. They're in there as well. But all in all, you're right. I mean, not a lot of people have actually seen this. The executions used to take place at midnight, which kind of even had a more kind of a veil of secrecy, as you would say, around it. It's something even in talking to people about having witnessed executions, people don't really want to hear about it.
Well, this is one of the issues, is that if we saw how this was carried out, society would think differently about it. And this is another a venue of this very wide-ranging article is the fact that some attitudes, at least among in law enforcement, is changing because of life without parole.
Yeah, that being an option that juries are increasingly being presented with. Yeah, a lot of cases are ending up with that being the sentence. And I know some people feel that that is even easier on the victims' families because they really are put through the ringer when they have to go and hear appeal after appeal after appeal in a death penalty case. I think a lot of times the victims' families that I've spoken with, they really just want, they don't want to have to hear from this person again. And so, yeah, life without parole, that has kind of changed some of how people view the death penalty. There's been a shift. In 1994, 80% of the population supported the death penalty, and that has decreased to about 60% of the population. Now, you still have, obviously,
an overwhelming majority
of the population supporting the death penalty, but things like exonerations through DNA evidence and all of that have contributed to a decline in support for it, and also the option of life without parole. One of the things I mentioned in the story, the option of life without parole is... it's interesting. I had a friend who was murdered in 1991. It was one of those stereotypical kind of convenience store clerk slayings, except this convenience store clerk was somebody I knew. We were all in our early 20s, and he worked at a convenience store, and he was robbed one night. And there were 2 teenagers who were accused in the shooting, and they kind of blamed each other for it, but one of them ended up with a sentence of life without parole. And you felt like that was kind of the end of it, except in 1996, he escaped from prison. And I can remember seeing that story. I was at work one day and that coming across and realizing, like, this is the guy who killed my friend, and he is now on the loose. And they recaptured him about 4 days later. But you know, for me, in a very personal way, for these.
You had no closure.
Right. You don't have closure anyway.
And you don't have closure. I think that's, you've interviewed a number of victims. Some do find closure from the carrying out of a capital sentence. Others don't.
Yeah, and that word is a hard word because it means different things to different people.
Yeah, you said you quit using that word in your stories.
Yeah, I couldn't define what that word meant. You can't write a story using a word you can't even define because people would mean it in different ways. I covered the Oklahoma City bombing as well. That's a mass murder scene. And so you're dealing with lots of victims' families. And, people over time, they would use the word closure a lot. And I learned that when I would ask them to explain what they meant, to some it meant vengeance. To some it meant seeing a carrying out of justice. To others, it meant just not having to hear from this person anymore. They just didn't want to have to deal with hearing this person who killed their loved one.
Or putting that episode behind them.
Yeah, they wanted to move on. They just, and I think in some cases, some saw it closure is just kind of a, like their grief wouldn't be so deep. But in talking to some families who had witnessed executions, they were surprised to discover it didn't bring about, at least immediately, because most of the time I talked to these people pretty quickly after it happened, it did not immediately bring that relief. To some it did. But some were surprised because the death penalty, when you're watching it carried out, for most people, I would think it's probably not what they think it is. Even when I'm sitting there, I will have gone over the case. You get this file from the Attorney General's office, this blue notebook that has everything in it. It has pictures from the murder scene. It has exactly what happened, what they're accused of. It has what they might have done in the past that, other crimes that may have contributed to it. So you have this very, horrific picture in your mind of what happened. And then you go in to watch the execution, and in most cases, it is a person mostly falling asleep and mm-hmm. becoming still. And so you have two different scenes. You have this murder scene in your mind, and then you have this scene occurring in front of you, and that is a fairly peaceful scene until you think about the fact they're actually strapped to that gurney. They can't move.
And it's a clinical scene.
Clinical scene. It's a very sterile feeling. It's a brightly lit room that you're looking into. I can kind of describe for you what it looks like.
Well, and we should just mention for a second, my guest today is Kelly Kurt, a former Associated Press correspondent. She was the bureau chief in Tulsa and now a freelance journalist. She is the author of the new cover story for the latest issue of This Land, Death's Yellow Door, Life Inside an Execution Chamber. She witnessed 16 executions over the course of her work with the AP and the latest for This Land. And, you were talking about this sterile scene. The title of the article sort of gives you this sort of incongruity. A bright yellow door is the entrance to the death chamber.
Yeah, that's the door all the witnesses walk through to go in. And you go in and there are two rows of metal folding chairs and you're kind of staggered on a platform. And you sit there and in front of you is a window. You're only about 3 or 4 feet away from this window. And there was a blind covering it. And when it's time for the execution to begin, the blind goes up, and it's largely like a stage curtain. I mean, it has that effect. It kind of adds to the surreal feeling of the scene. It goes up, and you're looking at a man or woman who is strapped to a gurney and covered in a sheet, and they can't move anything but their head. And a lot of times they are looking at you because they're seeing who's in the witness room. And you watch this whole scene play out. The media witnesses are there to record a last statement, to record what happens. So you're watching everything going on in the room. And in the few minutes after the blind goes up, the condemned person is given a chance to make a last statement. You're furiously trying to get that down as fast as you can. Sometimes you don't get it all, which is why after it's all over, the 12 media witnesses or whoever is in there, they get together and make sure we are in agreement on what was said. But after they make their last statement, the warden then says, let the execution begin. And what happens, there are three different drugs given. There are tubes running from the inmate's arms through these two holes in the wall, and the executioners are back behind this wall. You can't see them. And the first drug causes unconsciousness. The second stops their breathing, and the third stops their heart. For the most part, what I have witnessed is that after the first drug, I mean, they pretty quickly appear to be asleep. Mm-hmm. And then there might be kind of a snoring sound, kind of a little choking sound, and then they are still. And we sit there for about 5 minutes or so in complete silence, and what you're watching at this time is they're changing color. You're watching their death. Mm-hmm. They go from their skin color to a cold gray.
Yeah.
Color, and you have watched somebody die. And after they have checked the monitors to see that they're not having any impulses coming from the heart, then a doctor steps over and checks for pulse and then pronounces the time of death. And the blind goes back down. We file out. We get in a van, drive back to a media center, agree on what we heard and saw, and then you get to work writing your story and letting everybody know what happened.
And in that time, I would imagine you're sort of taking in, especially after you've seen this a few times, you're taking in sort of details that I would imagine there are things you're noticing after a number of these that you wouldn't have noticed before.
Right, yeah. There's a clock on the wall that you find yourself looking at. The warden is always, it seems at least, always standing there with his hands folded and just kind of waiting and looking around the room and not really making eye contact with anyone. And he's also checking watching the monitor, the heart monitor too. And and everybody kind of sees something a little different depending on where you are too in this process. Actually where you're sitting in the room. So it's kind of interesting when we get back to note some of the different things people have observed. You know, maybe a movement of their body in some way or, you know. Mm-hmm. In this execution in January, it was an unusual one for me because the inmate was chanting as he was given the drugs.
He was chanting sort of Nordic legends about Valhalla, Odin, and
Slay the Beast. Yeah, and uh-huh. And he did this, he basically chanted what you just said. He did it about 3 or 4 times, and then He choked on the last word. I mean, he was cut off midway. And usually most of the time they're not saying anything during that time period. After they make their last statement, they're quiet. And you don't really know exactly when the drugs have kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it stopped what he was saying. And mm-hmm. So that was, you know, kind of shocking in a way.
Yeah. My guest today is Kelly Kurt, former Associated Press correspondent and a freelance journalist today, the author of the cover story for the latest issue of This Land, Death's Yellow Door, Life Inside an Execution Chamber. She's witnessed 16 executions here in the state over the course of her journalistic career, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, this article is very powerful because you really try to get a very balanced view, talking to victims' families, to the accused families as well. And it's just, you know, there's nothing pretty about any of this. It's nothing pretty about the crimes committed that landed these accused in their situation. There's nothing pretty about carrying out of sentence.
No, and you really feel that even the position, being a media witness in that room, you are sitting with the victims' families right behind you. You can't see them, but they can see you. And then you're sitting with, oftentimes, the condemned person's family members right in front of you. They sit in the seats right in front of your knees. You're literally between these two worlds, you know, and it is, you know, I find myself empathizing with both because mm-hmm. it's like a lot of times the condemned person's mother is sitting right in front of you and it's a little old woman and she's got a tissue and she's crying. This is her son. This is, mm-hmm. you know. And, of course, behind you, those people have been through, I mean, years and years of waiting for this to happen. And, of course, years of their lives being completely turned upside down by the crime. So it's a strange position to be in. I think that's why there's such a weight of it, at least on me. I know other reporters may come out of there and not feel the same way. I have talked to others who, like me, over time begin to feel that it was so just a little harder to take, even when you didn't feel you were immediately affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
I had wanted for this article to interview there's an Associated Press reporter in Texas who has actually seen hundreds of executions.
Yeah,
and he was not available to mm-hmm. do it, but I was curious to know what that impact had been on his life.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're starting to see is we're starting to see a rethinking of what we do as far as incarcerating folks in our state. There's the Criminal Justice Reinvestment Initiative, which looks to try to reduce the population. And it's really sort of coalesced between, these are bad words to use, but liberal and conservative viewpoints. Conservatives look at the cost of the money of incarcerating. We haven't got to that point on capital punishment. Of course, it costs millions of dollars in appeals, at the cost of $30,000 a year per inmate. That's 100. Sometimes that's several hundred inmates to carry out one capital execution. Any sense that that is changing the way we look at capital punishment in the state?
Well, I don't know. When you look at the fact that 60% of the American people still support the death penalty, you kind of know why it's not an issue being brought up in elections, in campaigns. I mean, nobody talks about the death penalty, and certainly not in our state. So I don't know. It would be interesting to see if it is reexamined as part of this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote this article only because I felt like people needed to think about this issue, whether or not, no matter which way they stand on it at this point. It just seemed to me, in my years of not being a day-in, day-out journalist, that it's not something anybody thinks about.
It's out of sight, out of mind.
It is out of sight, out of mind. And feeling like I walk around with this burden of having actually been there to see it for the public and knowing maybe a lot of people didn't really care anyway, I just wanted to write about it. This land kind of gives you a lot of room to write about these things. And so even though I have covered these executions and written lots of stories about them, this was a chance to kind of bring it all together. And again, no matter what side people are on in this, just to bring it up so people can think about it, because this is human life. We're killing somebody, and it's our society that's made the decision to do that, and we need to think about that, I think.
I think, getting back to that argument that death penalty opponents make, if this was more of a public situation, do you think that 60% approval rate would be there? Because, having witnessed it several times.
What I can say about that is, it's hard to know, like, say executions were televised, what kind of that could turn into. People have argued that they should be televised, and who knows, kind of knowing how that can be turned into a circus, I'm not sure about that. But I think for at least people in Oklahoma who maybe have an idea that the death penalty is this eye for an eye kind of solution to things, I think they might actually be surprised if they saw one carried out, because it's not exactly that. It's not equal to the crime that occurred, at least visually.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's also because they happen years, maybe even a decade later. That person that is strapped to the gurney is not the person that committed
right.
that crime
a lot
either.
A lot of those people have made peace with God.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about that in their last statement. A lot of them have deep regrets for what happened. Many don't. I mean, I've not always seen people apologize for the crimes. I've seen them apologize to their own family and not to the victim's family. But it's just something that needs to be carefully weighed, I think, because it's occurring years later. And a lot of the prison officials will tell you that it's easy to handle or oversee death row inmates because they have kind of come to a different place in their lives. They're different people. So. Mm. It's something to think about.
Yeah. Well, it's a very well-written article, and it's very balanced between talking to victims' families as well as the accused families, a look at sort of the issues behind capital punishment in the state, discrepancies in who ends up on death row. It comes from just a couple of counties.
Right.
Really.
It's pretty interesting.
Is there any sign that the prosecutors in general are a little more reluctant to go for capital punishment?
Well, I know you spoke with Sister Helen Prejean about this, and so yeah, I mean, she's more of an expert in that area than I would be, but I think a lot of places are looking at the cost, for sure.
It'll be interesting to see, as you know, in the last few years, the state has not had all that much money. Maybe that's going to have an effect down the road as well. We'll have to see. Anyway, it's a very well-written article. Death's Yellow Door, Life Inside an Execution Chamber is the cover story for the latest issue of This Land. Kelly Curt, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly Curt is a former Associated Press correspondent, a freelance journalist, and the author of the cover story for the latest issue of This Land, Death's Yellow Door, Life Inside an Execution Chamber. You can learn more at thislandpress.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Colin Hines.
According to a study conducted by the Urban Institute, Oklahoma and other states stand much to gain by the implementation of a health care insurance exchange as required by the Affordable Care Act. That's the act derisively called Obamacare by those who trust insurance companies to be more concerned with our health than with their profits. Currently, 597,000 Oklahomans are uninsured, which is more than one out of every 10 citizens. According to the study, the number of uninsured Oklahomans will drop to 259,000 after the implementation of the act. Some $866 million worth of health care delivery goes uncompensated each year in Oklahoma. That sum is absorbed by the bottom line of private providers and government agencies. In Oklahoma, that amount would shrink to $277 million after the act goes into effect, the study claims. Governor Fallon, after taking heat from conservative lawmakers, refused a $54 million grant from the federal government that would have been used by Oklahoma to craft and implement an insurance exchange. In opposition to the grant, one lawmaker warned that creating an exchange is the, quote, first step of Obamacare, unquote. Governor Fallon makes it clear that she panders to our misguided instincts on this issue. To paraphrase the statement on her website, quote, "One thing we won't see is socialized medicine. I've worked in Congress to fight Obamacare, and I'll continue that fight as governor," unquote. At what cost, though? The grant money would have enabled Oklahoma to create an exchange with input from our insurance commission and Medicaid agencies. That money would have gone to compensate Oklahomans hired to construct the exchange in a way that is uniquely suited to Oklahoma. Oklahoma has refused to put an exchange in place for purely ideological reasons, an irony not lost on the authors of the Urban Institute study. The study points out, quote, "States that have made the least progress towards establishing their exchanges are likely to benefit the most from the act in terms of covering their uninsured population," unquote. However, if we elect to drag our collective and ideological heels on establishing an exchange, to the detriment of our economy and our health, the federal government will eventually do it for us, however it sees fit.
Colin Hines is a local attorney, a freelance writer, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online at publicradiotulsa.org or subscribe to the Studio Tulsa podcast at the iTunes store. It's absolutely free. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.